From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
Another nuclear test by North Korea drew criticism from, among others, Lesina Zerbo, Executive Secretary of the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty Organization, this past Friday.
Frightening, unfortunate, and then a serious breach to the already internationally norm adopted by the international community.
China and Russia are set to hold unprecedented joint maneuvers in the South China Sea with the navies of each country participating in live fire practice. Tan Jigun is the director of the Center for Arms Control at the China Institute of International Studies.
Of course, by doing this, the two sides share the strategic goal to maintain the peace and stability in this region. And anti-submarine operation and amphibious or island landing operation are the most two sophisticated items for any maritime drill. They just to show the solid trust between the two countries. For example, during an anti-submarine operation, you have to share your intelligence, mm-hmm. your capability mm-hmm. with other units in mm-hmm. the operation. Mm-hmm. So this is actually a good relation between the two militaries mm-hmm. and also show the good political trust. This is actually a foundation for the military, good relation between China and Russia.
The Saudi-backed terrorist group of Ahrar al-Sham rejected a U.S.-Russian brokered ceasefire deal to halt fighting in Syria that's set to begin late Monday. The group announced the decision in a video statement released hours before the truce was set to go into effect. They claimed it would only reinforce the Syrian government's position and increase the suffering of civilians. Ahrar al-Sham is closely affiliated with the Nusra Front, which recently renamed itself to Jabhat Fateh al-Sham. Russia's been trying to add the two groups to the UN list of terrorist groups over their ties to al-Qaeda and Daesh. However, the U.S. has refused to allow that designation to pass. Here in the U.S., Republican presidential candidate Donald Trump and vice presidential nominee Mike Spence hit back at Democratic candidate Hillary Clinton for calling Trump supporters a basket of deplorables.
You know, to just be grossly generalistic, you could put half of Trump supporters into what I call the basket of deplorables. Right? The racist, sexist, homophobic, xenophobic, Islamophobic, you name it.
Trump said in a statement that the former First Lady's bigotry and hatred for millions of Americans showed she was not fit to be president. He added that Clinton would pay the price for her words in the November election. For many, it invoked Republican nominee Mitch Romney's famous 47% comment back in 2012, which he told Chris Wallace of Fox News cost him the election.
There are 47% of the people who have voted for the president no matter what. All right, there are 47% who are with him, who are dependent upon government, who believe that they are victims, who believe that government has a responsibility to care for them, who believe that they're entitled to health care, to food, to housing, to you name it. And they will vote for this president no matter what.
With more on that, we speak with our political analyst, Du Boisian scholar and professor of political science, Tony Montero, via Skype from Philadelphia, Monday. Professor Montero, welcome back.
Thank you, Don.
So we're not going to waste any time with Hillary Clinton's flu or illness. We could chat about that for a long time. But the heart of the matter centers around her questioning the basically her characterizing half of Trump supporters as being as a basket of deplorables.
Mm-hmm.
And then list them as racists and Islamophobes or whatever. And then comes back, of course, and says that essentially your campaign is saying, and all of the campaign operatives are out saying over the weekend, well, where she was wrong was saying half. And taking that in the context of Romney getting sunk by his 47% comment back in 2012, and these studies that are looking at this phenomenon, or really this the movement that's behind Trump's campaign, that tries to dissect it and understand it. And we've got some studies that we've looked at and discussed you know, some polls from Pew and Gallup, and it's really interesting looking at this from that perspective.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you're right. I mean, and I think Clinton's words and what we get from the Pew study and other studies is beginning to show a, at least in my perception, a type of desperation on the part of elites in dealing with something they never thought they'd have to deal with, and that is an upsurge, especially of white working people, but I'm convinced not just them, on questions of neoliberal policies, globalization, the economic organization of global capital, and so on. And this, of course, the questioning and rejection of these elite policies, which frankly, you know, took off under Bill Clinton's administration and went forward from there, and which Hillary Clinton is the face of in this election, the rejection of those policies based upon their effects upon working people overlap with a rejection of wars for regime change and wars with Russia and China. This is very significant, and the fact that it is coming from those parts of the working class that had been Republican and are Republican voters, but not just them, is a real a problem for elite thinkers, elite commentators, and really for this election cycle going forward. This is amazing, and it's a new moment in the political history of this country.
Yeah, so they characterize this group. And, you know, you have the culture. You got Archie Bunker. I mean, you know, when I was becoming politically active the first time in my life, in my late teens, you know, the adversaries were hard hats, union workers. And mm-hmm. there was in the culture Archie Bunker and all these, all D's and Doe's guys that were, you know, ignoramuses, racists, xenophobes. Mm-hmm. And that was the white working class in the United States in the minds of the culture, really, in the presentation in the culture. And yet, Marx would probably perhaps agree with some of the descriptions, but not the character, certainly. He would look at them mm-hmm. as workers, where they stand in relation to the means of production. Looking at definitions in these studies, for example, and the characterizations and the presentation format also of the data, it seems that they're having a hard time honing in on white workers, that is, people who stand in relation to the means of production as the actual producers, the laborers, the workers, the ones that add value with their work to some material for the end product that gets sold by the owners. The 1%, and they have all kinds of weird constructs that they use to bring this information forward. But it still shows that the character of Trump's voters is essentially working class,
right? And whose situation is precarious,
right?
And even though they want to make this distinction between blue and white collar workers, as though white-collar workers are not also exploited, such as office workers, even some elements of the managerial workforce, which are part of the overall production process. They try to make it as though these are not working-class people and only blue-collar workers or people with less than a college education are really working class. And this is a biased, prejudiced, really anti-materialist definition. And now the researchers who are trying to explain what's going on are trapped in their own definitions, which are flawed from the start and have been flawed and were invented by a sociologist right after World War II and the Great Depression to make the argument that, first of all, there is not a sizable working class in the United States, that the biggest class is the middle class. And this is not based upon your relationship to production or the means of production,
right,
as you mentioned, but is based upon your values, your income, where you live, what you strive for, and that type of thing. And of course, those definitions carried a huge racist and white supremacist essence, because the middle class was white, the underclass is predominantly black, and there's a small working class somewhere in this mix. Well, now we're seeing something that is upsetting all of those so-called truths of sociology and survey research. So as we have talked continually over these months, what we're looking at is an upsurge. It took two political forms in this electoral process. It was, on the one side, Bernie Sanders, and there has been hardly any real study and investigation of the class character of that, but we do know it was similar to the Trump insurgency by the issues that they saw as paramount. And they were the trade issues. They were the war and peace issues. These are issues that strike at the heart of a deterioration of working class and lower middle class standards of living. And of course, this upsurge is only the beginning of a class awakening. And even though this awakening was restricted because it was a part of a political campaign in two parties that are controlled by big money. Now, of course, Trump defeated the major centers of elite big money control of the Republican Party. And the question is whether there is a national Republican Party, or a Republican Party that is the vehicle, a mechanism of the presidential campaign of Donald Trump. But Bernie's campaign fell short for the reasons that we've discussed over and over again. But nonetheless, given the narrow boundaries of possibility, what we saw were working class upsurges, and they drew or got the attention, let me put it this way, of people in the working class and among the poor far beyond those who participated in these primary elections. In other words, the impact of both of these campaigns went way beyond the people who have voted for them. And no matter what happens in November, this will become a permanent part of politics and social movements going forward in this country.
Yeah, and we're seeing that as a phenomenon that is based, as you say, in this awakening that's sort of been forced on particularly white working class people, but really the entire working class, you know, just by the prevalence of precariousness in their condition at this point in time, unemployment and foreclosure and evictions and no health care and student debt, all these things. That actually is helping to deconstruct this construct that was assembled end of the New, during the New Deal, even by sociologists, and this idea of the great American middle class, which was based not on class, in other words, small producers, which is what the classic definition would be, but rather on income and accumulated wealth and social things, status and other intangibles. Since the material part of that prescription, of that cocktail, which was income and wealth, those two have deteriorated or disappeared for millions and millions of members that identified as middle class before, and in the aftermath of the prevalence of the concept of a 1% and a 99%, the reality is hit home pretty hard.
Right. Absolutely. Absolutely. And, these trade deals, and especially this TPP and this TIPP, cannot be taken out of the mix. And what we see is an awareness incubating within the working class. It has caused, as I said, shock and awe in the elite. Going back to the spring of this year with the primaries, you remember coming out of the conservative and right-wing think tanks were attacks upon Donald Trump's voters, that they were ignorant, that they were lazy. I mean, much of the language that American sociology, going back to Daniel Moynihan, had used in characterizing the black poor was now being used to define and describe the white poor who were attracted to Donald Trump. And so when Hillary comes out and says in effect that these are despicable people, what I think they are in essence saying, how dare you challenge our mode of governing and ruling over you? You are not intelligent enough, and in fact, as human beings, don't have, are not qualified, I should say, to criticize or challenge us. You are supposed to go along with what we tell you to do, and you are supposed to stay in your lane. Now, I think, looking forward, that at some point, both sides of the color line are going to see something they have in common. One, the economic conditions, of course, but that they're looked down upon the elites. Interestingly, Trump has said and made this point that the elite, especially in the Democratic Party, has failed the African-American community. Earlier in the primary process, he said to white working people, the elite who run the Republican Party have failed you. I mean, oh, I'm sorry.
Could one argue that point at all, really?
I mean, I think it's such a powerful argument. Right. I mean, with all of Trump's inadequacies, and they are multiple, and you can, you don't have to be a rocket scientist to discover them. There's so much about him that can turn you off. But if that's all you see, when he had said in the spring to white working and poor people, the elite of the Republican Party have sold you out, have failed you. And by the elite, he didn't just mean the Romneys. He's talking about the evangelicals. He was talking about the Tea Party people. He was talking about the Koch brothers. He was talking about the Heritage Foundation. The whole tangle of elites that controlled or thought they controlled public opinion and movement among white, poor, and working class people. Trump won by saying to those people, those white elites have sold you out. They have failed you. They've instituted policies of trade and war that go against your interests. Then he comes out and says to black people, the elite in the Democratic Party have failed you. But he had previously said that the whole system is rigged against working people and the poor. I mean, this is, if nothing else, the most accurate narrative of the politics of control and domination of the working class, black, white, Mexican, and otherwise, gay, straight, transgendered. If you're a part of the working class, you are a victim of the same elites, be those elites identified as Republicans or Democrats. And this is powerful stuff. This is stuff that we can build upon going into the future. This is, and that's why I call this, a class awakening. And it's now morphed into a wider class awakening. And it is not restricted to the boundaries of race. It is a class uprising. And I can tell you from my perception and discussion with people here in Philadelphia, black, poor, and working people are looking very, very closely at Trump, what he is saying, and are looking at our own black misleadership class in class terms and asking questions about what it means when of the last five mayors of Philadelphia, three of them have been black, and, you know, police chiefs and superintendent of schools and so on being black, but the conditions of black people are worse today than in recent memory. And the inequalities based upon race and class are wider in Philadelphia today than before this political movement of black empowerment. So I think we're looking at a new moment of class conflict objectively. It's not exclusive or limited to the presidential election, but the presidential election is bringing it to the fore.
Yeah, you've got so many contradictions that are operating, too. The first person to introduce these class concepts into the public discourse is a billionaire. But, of course, the fact exists that if anyone other than a billionaire or anyone other than a reality TV star or someone that draws big audience that you need to be part of your show, like CNN and all of them, mention those things, they would turn the camera off, but they can't do that to Trump because their ratings go down. So there are very few people who can actually bring that message. And so with all of the things that he says that are, you know, abhorrent, when they attack him, they also make certain that they attack those proponents of the economic policies that are at the and the war policies that are at the heart of his basically his dissidents.
Right. Yeah. And you know, see, there are a couple of things going on. I mean, the elite were caught by surprise. This was not supposed to happen.
Right.
You know,
Sanders.
First
too.
Of all.
And Sanders. Not
Sanders. I'm talking about Trump.
I'm talking about both of them. Yeah.
Yes, right. Absolutely. This is inconceivable to the elites. This is not supposed to happen. You know? And of course, Trump, with his hair, with his color, his tanning process, and the way he talks and his persona. Well, you know, they didn't think it could ever happen. And here's a guy that got more votes in the Republican primary than anybody in history.
Right.
And defeats all of the elites. But they also underestimated his base.
Yeah.
Those people that he brought into this thing. And they heard him better than anybody else did. And, you know, it's just the fact that... you know, you get into the industrial Midwest, the Upper South. These are people who think, act, and look at the world differently than elites on the East and West Coast. So they underestimated the masses. And as you said, the same thing with Bernie Sanders. Now we're on the cusp of another major crisis, and not the last one, by the way, in this election cycle: the health of Hillary Clinton and how that's going to be handled. Because the electorate is very, very aware of the fact that it's a very secretive, small group of operatives that have a public face that is that they present through their PR, and then the media, the main so-called liberal media, picks it up and promotes it. But you never know what's happening with her and who's behind her and so on and so forth. So this is a big crisis beyond health. It's a question of, do we really know who Hillary Clinton is? But then in 2 weeks, we have the first debate, right, and Julian Assange has said that he has another set of emails to drop before that debate, and he says they will establish that Hillary Clinton is beyond doubt guilty of crimes.
So do you think maybe this sickness thing is being developed to sort of have her step down for reasons of her health in a way that wouldn't contaminate someone? Because the elite thinks, oh, no, we're going to lose with her, or we might lose with her.
I think they have to be in a state of panic. Mm. I know when I looked at the video from yesterday of her state, as she tried to stabilize herself to get into the van, it was horrifying to see. She was obviously very, very ill. Of course, they're saying she has pneumonia. That's possible, but I think there's more to it. But I think there has been a plan B and even a plan C for some weeks, maybe months, which looked at what they would do if she would be forced to drop out. I felt, going back to July, as the Republican convention was coming here to Philadelphia.
The Democratic Convention in Philadelphia.
The Democratic Party Convention,
yeah.
Which kind of morphed into the Republican Party.
It looked like USA.
But, with numbers showing that 70% of the electorate did not trust her.
Right.
I mean, those were historic numbers. And then her negatives began to increase.
Yeah.
Even after the convention.
Right.
And so I think going back maybe a couple of months, certainly several weeks, those who are running the Democratic Party were aware that they had to have a plan B and a plan C to replace her. And you might be right, the health situation, and I think that's real. I think there are some health issues, might be a way for her to step down.
Yeah. All right. We'll pick it up there next time. Tony Montero, Professor, thank you very much. Appreciate your time as always.
Thank you very much, Don.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.